Chapter 13. He was only a few yards behind where I'd been, close enough to keep a good eye on me if that's what he'd been doing there, far enough away that he couldn't have quite reached out and grabbed me if that was his goal. I took a step backwards, landing on someone's fingers, jerking my foot up, nearly skidding on a slick of used food and toxic chemicals. I caught my balance, took another step. Knothead hadn't spotted me yet. He wasn't wearing tactical black, but I saw that his blue jeans had a couple of bulging cargo pockets, and there were a few little bulges around his waistline. I took another step and looked carefully around me. Would Knothead have been here alone? Would he have had Timmy with him? Ziz didn't strike me as the kind of organization that sent its goons out on their own. I looked all around me, finding new reservoirs of panic and fear, searching the crowd for guys who could be Timmy, wondering if he might be wearing a wig or some other disguise. I didn't see him, but I did spot Lemmy helping an older guy who was limping, his arm around Lemmy's shoulders. I started to move toward him, and then I felt a hand take mine. For a glorious moment, I thought Ange had crept up on me and grabbed my hand. Somehow I could feel that these were a woman's fingers. Then, the fingers grabbed hold of my thumb and did something awful and painful to it, something that made my head snap back in pain. I cried out, the sound muffled by my mask, and tried to squirm away from the terrible, wrenching pain. That only made it worse. I went up on my tiptoes in agony and managed to twist around and see who was the author of my suffering. It was Carrie Johnstone, dressed like a sitcom housewife doing the grocery shopping in track pants, a loose SFSU sweatshirt, her hair tied back in a scrunchie. It was such a great disguise, so utterly unlike her efficient, ruthless persona, that I couldn't figure out where I knew that stern face from at first. When I did, I gasped harder. "Hello, Marcus," she said, and relaxed her grip on my thumb just a little so that I could catch my breath and focus for a moment. She watched my eyes carefully, and when she was convinced that I was paying full attention, she brought her other hand out from beneath her sweatshirt. In it, she held a little two-pronged, pistol-gripped tactical black gizmo, a taser. "I'd prefer not to use this," she said, "because then I'd have to carry you. That would be conspicuous, and I might have to drop you. You wouldn't like that. Am I being clear?" I nodded and swallowed a few times behind my mask. She made the taser vanish. "Smart boy. Come along now, we've got to move." It was full night now, and as the people around us regained their feet, there was chaos, shoving and pushing in the dark, crying and some screams and retching. Every now and again I'd hear someone shout, "Mic check!" and some weak echoes as people tried to establish order, but Carrie Johnstone always steered me away from those places, pushing me ahead of her like a battering ram, still gripping my thumb but hardly twisting it. Instead, she pulled it this way and that, steering me with it as if it were a joystick. Somewhere behind us, I could hear the police bullhorns giving orders to sit down and put your hands on your head. And then I heard Johnstone curse, and she started pushing me faster. The night blurred past, but something was nagging at me. Carrie Johnstone and Knothead had been at the protest, looking for me, I suppose, and they'd have been caught in the herf burst. They were all about tactical this and tactical that, but would they have thought to put their clever devices inside Faraday pouches? Johnstone said the reason she hadn't tased me was that she didn't want to carry me. But really, would it be that hard for her to drag me out of the crowd? Would it be that conspicuous? I was willing to bet that Johnstone could bench press a water buffalo. And the million-dollar question, was there enough electronic circuitry in a dumb little taser to make it vulnerable to a herf blast? I crashed into an old man whose face was streaked with dirt and tears, his face looming out of the night, eyes wide and surprised. He barely had time to register the fact that I was about to collide with him before we were going down in a tangle. As we fell, I felt Carrie Johnstone's grip tighten on my thumb, try to wrench it into that special configuration of torment and slip. I coiled my legs under me and sprang into the night like a jackrabbit, scrambling to get away, using hands and feet to get through the crowd, running blindly in the darkness. Behind me, I heard outraged cries and wondered if they were from the people I'd hurtled past or from people who were being tossed aside by the vengeful hands of Carrie Johnstone. I ran so hard I lost my breath and couldn't catch it, couldn't get even a sip of air to pass my throat, but I forced myself to run on, even as my vision blackened around the edges, telescoping again. I had been running west, and something about the buildings around me made me think I was getting away from the protest center, out toward the edge. Soon I might escape to the real world, a place away from relentless pursuers and gas and crowds. Keeping that in my mind, I forced one foot in front of the other, gulping like a fish in my wet, claustrophobic mask. It wasn't going to work. I wasn't going to make it. Any second now I was going to fall to my knees, and a second after that Carrie Johnstone would have me. Even without the taser she was going to have to carry me, things inside me were wearing out, bursting, breaking, and once I stopped moving, I wouldn't be able to start again. But there was the edge of the crowd. I could see it. See the place where the wall of people ended and the city began. Just a few more steps. The lights ahead glittered in my foggy, steamed-up goggles. I was so fixated on them, I didn't even see the police line that divided the protest from the real world, a line of helmeted men wearing bouquets of plastic handcuffs at their waists, hard-faced, hands encased in black gloves. I almost stopped myself then, but I didn't. Maybe I couldn't have. In any event, I was pretty sure that Carrie Johnstone couldn't kidnap me from jail. One step, two steps. And then I was crashing into a policeman. I actually smelled his cologne and the hamburger on his breath as he absorbed the weak momentum of my last stumbling rush. He steadied me, took in my mask and goggles, spotted the plastic handcuff around one wrist, grabbed hold of the loose cuff, jerked my arm around, grabbed my other arm, and cuffed it. I was handled as impersonally as a sack of potatoes as another cop stepped forward out of the line and directed me to one of the waiting buses I'd spotted from the sky. Before he put me inside, he patted me down, reaching for my phone, then stopping when his gloved hand encountered some of the vomit I'd been spattered with. He said, "That a cell phone?" "Yeah," I said. "It's dead, though." "Right," he said. "They'll take it from you when you get processed anyway." There were already a couple dozen people in the darkness and quiet of the bus. Some were young, some were old, some were brown or Asian, some were white. It was laid out like a school bus, the kind of thing I'd ridden 1,000 times on school trips, except for the steel mesh separating the driver's seat and back of the bus from the rest of the interior. Each seat held 2 people, and they were loading us from the back forward. I was halfway down the bus's length, and I had a seatmate, a guy in black jeans and sweatshirt. He was unconscious and breathing shallowly. The officer who led me to him didn't say anything as he guided me down into the seat with an impersonal air that was neither hostile nor friendly. I jostled the guy and he made a whimpering noise like a hurt animal. "I think this guy needs medical help," I said, squirming in my seat to find a comfortable way of sitting with my arms lashed together behind me. "He'll get it," the cop said, "soon as he's processed." There were murmured conversations around me, the voices tight and scared, like the voices of kids hiding from a killer in a slasher movie. I stared out the windows, looking for any sign of Carrie Johnstone or Knothead, or Ange or Lemmy for that matter. At 5-minute intervals, I remembered that I had forgotten to write a lawyer's phone number on my arm and thought about what an idiot I was. Against all odds, I actually drifted off to sleep for a while, leaning forward with my head against the back of the seat in front of mine. I guess my body had used up so much adrenaline that there just wasn't anything left to keep me awake. On top of everything else, I had the mother of all caffeine withdrawal headaches. I would have happily eaten a pound of espresso beans and asked for seconds. I woke up when someone was plunked down in the seat in front of mine. I looked up groggily and saw that it was a girl about my age. She was Middle Eastern looking, with designer clothes and long hair that had mostly escaped from its ponytail. She had a look of utter, grim determination. "Hey," I said to the cop, "hey, are we going to get to go to the bathroom soon?" "After you're processed," the cop said. "When's that?" "Later." "Come on, we've been in here forever. Could you at least take my cuffs off?" "No." The cop turned on his heel and left. The weird thing was how impersonal the whole thing had been. The guy could have been telling a panhandler that he didn't have any spare change. "How long have you been in here?" the girl said. "I don't know," I said. I nodded off. "A while. Do you know what time it is?" She shrugged. "I think it must be after 11. "What's going on out there?" "Oh," she said. "They're questioning everyone. If they don't like your answers, you go behind the fence." "The fence? You didn't see it?" "There's a big area, a block square, all fenced in with movable barriers. They don't like you, they put you there. Then they talk to you some more. If they still don't like you, they bring you here." "You didn't go to the fence, huh?" I thought about explaining that I'd been chased into a cop by a psychotic war criminal merc. I said, "Nope, I just got grabbed and put here." She shook her head. "Not me. They grabbed me, checked my ID, penned me in, checked my ID again, put me here. Bastards. Why do you think they grabbed you? She shrugged again. I don't know. Racism? These days having an Egyptian last name is like being called Jasmina bin Terrorist al-Jihad. Or maybe it's because I belong to ECWR. What's that? Women's group, she said. The Egyptian Center for Women's Rights. Solidarity with women in the Middle East. The women came out for the revolutions, helped overthrow the dictators, spilled their blood. Then the new revolutionary government sent them back home, started running around talking about modesty and a woman's place. So we talk about it here, have discussion groups, produce literature about what the Quran actually says about women. We call them out for their bullshit. She shrugged again. So maybe that's it. I don't know. I tried to call my family when I was in the fenced area, but my phone didn't work. No one's did. Huh. Do you have a lawyer you could call? No, she said. But my mother would know someone. Once she got over having a heart attack about me being arrested. What does it matter, though? I dropped my voice to a whisper. I have a working phone. The unconscious guy next to me stirred. He cracked one eyelid and said something indistinct. What? I said, leaning in.
415-285-1011, he said. National Lawyers Guild number for San Francisco. If you've got a phone, I'd appreciate it if you'd call them for me.
There was a guard sitting at the front of the bus, on the other side of the heavy wire mesh that enclosed us. He wasn't paying much attention. Or maybe he had a hidden mic and was listening to every word through a headphone in the ear I couldn't see. Right, I said. Do you think you could get your fingers in my pocket if I move around so you can reach? He shifted, made a hissing noise like a tea kettle.
Don't think so. I expect my arm's busted.
I looked more closely. The arm closest to me was definitely at a funny angle. He must have been in agony. I turned back to the girl ahead of me.
Do you think you could get the phone out of my pocket?
She craned around to look at me.
Maybe, she said doubtfully. How are we going to dial it?
Dunno, I said.
Let's burn that bridge when we come to it.
I twisted around to get my hip to stick out in the vicinity of the girl's bound hands. I jostled the guy with the broken arm in the process, and he made another hissing sound, but didn't say anything when I said sorry. The next part was really hard. We had both moved, so we were sitting on the seats with our legs in the aisle. My phone was in my front pocket, so to get it close to her, I had to turn around so I wasn't facing her anymore and scooch backwards to where her hands had been. Then she had to find my pocket with her bound hands, working blind, facing away from me.
Ew, she said. It's not mine, I said. Someone puked on me. That's so much more comforting, thanks.
She got her thumb and forefinger into my pocket, pushed in farther, gripped my phone, started to tug it out of my pocket. She got it most of the way out and lost her grip, and I thought the phone was going to fall on the floor, but I kind of twisted my hip so that it ended up slipping back. She tried again, and this time she got it out.
Give me a sec, she said. These cuffs are so tight I can barely move my hands, and wriggling like that didn't help.
Take your time, I said. Can you get the phone into my hand? I backed up until my fingers brushed hers, and she pressed the phone into my hand. While she flexed her fingers and wrists, trying to get the blood to circulate, I turned my phone around in my hands behind my back. I remembered the days when phones had actual buttons you could find by touch and dial without seeing them. I could feel the phone in my hand in its familiar grip, my thumb over the power button. I turned it on and ran my finger over the screen, feeling the familiar haptic buzz, the little vibrations the phone emitted each time my finger brushed over a hot region on the screen to let me know that I was in a spot that could make the phone do something. Running my fingertip up the screen, I carefully counted out the four buzzes from bottom to top and the three from left to right, trying to figure out where the number pad layout was drawn. This was the lock screen for my phone, which I'd configured to take a super strong 8-digit password because, you know, I'm paranoid like that. Gee, thanks, paranoid me. I was going to have to try to key in 8 numbers correctly, blind with half-numb hands, without alerting the police.
What are you doing? The girl in front of me asked.
I think my finger is on the number 1. Is that right?
I don't know. You're holding the phone upside down.
Oh, this was going to be great. I rotated my wrists around so that the screen was facing her. Incidentally, this also made my fingers feel like I was trying to do the world's stupidest and hardest magic trick.
Your fingers are on the 1, the 9, the 3, and the 6.
Now I rearranged my hand again so that only one of my index fingers was on the glass. So now I had my hands in the stupid magic trick pose, and was gripping the phone only by its edges.
Now your finger is on the one.
I moved it. Three, right?
Right, but you got the two on the way.
I bit my tongue and started to count in my head.
When I got to 20, she said, "Okay, it's reset."
It took 6 tries. After the 5th try, the phone locked itself, and we had to wait for 10 tense minutes until it unlocked itself. Security is awesome.
"Okay, you've done it," she said. I could barely feel my hands.
"Who do we call first?"
"My mom," she said. "She knows a crapload of lawyers."
It took more fumbling to press the button that brought up the dialer, and then an eternity to get her mom's number keyed in correctly. At least the dialer let me press the backspace button when I screwed up.
"You've done it," she said,
loud enough that people in the other seat shifted and looked around. I closed my hand around my phone, trying to hide it without inadvertently pressing any of the buttons. We waited until everyone had gone back to their solitary misery, and then I said,
"Okay, how do we do this?"
"Do what?"
"I'm going to call your mom, right? How are you going to talk to her from up there when the phone is down here?"
"Oh,
yeah."
"How high can you get your arms?"
I tried. It actually felt good to lift them some, working the kinks out of my shoulder blades, but I was left wishing I'd gone to more yoga classes with Ange. The woman, I still didn't know her name, isn't that funny? Shifted behind me, and I felt her prod the call button with her nose or tongue, and then my fingertips tingled with the sound of the phone ringing. From where I sat, I saw several of my fellow prisoners watching with expressions ranging from bemusement to delight to fear. I heard, felt someone answer, a kind of buzz-buzz that my fingers translated as, "Hello?" And then the girl whispered,
"Mama,"
and started to talk in a low, urgent whisper, speaking a language I didn't know. Arabic, I guess? Is that what they speak in Egypt? The bus was brightly lit, but we had been locked in it for ages, hours, it felt like, since the last prisoners were brought in. Surely the guard at the front was half asleep or bored stupid, or maybe he was stupid to begin with. Either way, I felt a welcome sense of superiority. They might be heavily armed. They might be able to arrest us and stick us in their plastic cuffs. They might be able to jail us and try us for crimes they'd invented just for the occasion. But they couldn't control us utterly and totally. Here we were, right in the belly of the beast. And we'd cooperated to establish a channel to the outside world. Between the gas and the violence and the sleep deprivation, I felt a strange madness creep over me, a sense that I was invulnerable and invincible, that I was destined to win because I was able to do the things that the hero of the story would do. And don't heroes always win? The first clue I had as to my total vincibility, my utter vulnerability, was when the eyes of the prisoners behind me on the bus widened in unison, turning to comical expressions of horror that made them all look like they were somehow related, cousins in a family of genetically frightened people. The next clue was the terrified squeak from the girl behind me, and then the final clue a bare instant later. The phone knocked out of my hands, my wrists grabbed by a glove hand and yanked so high and so fast that I barely had time to lever myself out of the seat, bending almost double, forehead impacting painfully with the floor as I sought to escape the wrenching, tearing agony in my shoulders. Then there was a face beside mine, so I heard the click of its teeth in my ear, so close I could smell the gum on its breath. It belonged to my tormentor, who said, "Kid, no one likes a smartass." My hands were released, and I whimpered as my arms snapped back, my fists kind of bouncing off my butt, my face grinding into the dirty floor of the bus. Before I could get my breath, the same hands had my ankles, and the familiar dread sound of plastic handcuffs being ratcheted along their closure mechanism ripped through the air, as one ankle, then the other, were cinched tight enough to hurt. The hands kept moving. My wrists were jerked back as the plastic between them was caught and hauled back up, the man working over me grunting softly, a curiously tender sound, and another set of cuffs were attached to the plastic between them. Then my ankles were hauled up toward my wrists, and my fogged-over brain realized that I was about to be hog-tied. I kicked and bucked and shouted something, I don't know what, maybe not even words, just a kind of howl, a no that ripped from my guts to my throat. I began to worm my way down the length of the bus, trying to get away from the tormentor in his hands. The other prisoners got their feet out of the way, giving me passage, and I heard them shout things at the guard who was pursuing me, "Shame!" in a dozen voices. I reached the cage at the back of the bus and squirmed and wormed my way around on it, turning to face back up the aisle.
The police officer, a young white guy whose hat had been knocked off, a look on his face like a vengeful god, was trying to come after me, but the other prisoners on the bus had stretched their ankles back into the aisles, making a forest of legs that the cop had to bull past. He reached for the nightstick on his belt, had it halfway out of its ring when he seemed to think better of it, and shifted his grip to his can of mace. He lifted it up like bug spray, shifting the mask around his neck over his face as he did, settling the goggles around his eyes with gloved fingers. The prisoners who saw what he was doing retracted their legs one by one until the way between the guard and me was open. He blinked twice at me. "It's okay," I said. "I'll sit quietly. You don't have to tie me up." He took two steps toward me, holding the mace in front of him like a vampire hunter holding up a crucifix. Like a vampire, I shrank away from it. My world telescoped down to the nozzle of the mace bottle, the square aperture with the little round nozzle within. "Please," I said. His finger tightened on the trigger. The bottle was inches from my face, aimed right at a spot midway between my mouth and nose. "Tom," a voice called from the front of the bus, "what the hell is going on here?" The guard's finger froze. He slipped the bottle back into its pouch on his Batman belt, turned around on his heel, looked up the length of the bus at an older cop with a couple stripes on his shoulder, an inspector. The guard walked the length of the bus to his boss, and the two of them had a quiet, intense conversation. Every pair of eyes on the bus was glued to them, every ear cocked to them. Tom's back was to me, and I could see from where I stood that his shoulders were as tight as a tennis racket. It was clear to me that he was getting some kind of dressing down. I confess that I felt a little smug to see this guy get told off, but mostly I was still crapping myself with residual fear. Tom got off the bus, and the inspector marched down the bus without a word, grabbed me by the arm, and half-dragged me back to my seat, while I tried to keep upright by shuffling my bound feet in a frantic penguin gait. He pushed me impersonally into my seat and turned on his heel without a word.
"You should have called the lawyers first," the guy beside me said. I didn't say anything.
The lights in the bus went off, and the engine roared to life, and we were off. The girl in front of me apologized over the bump and the growl of the bus as we rattled through the night. The irony was that her mom had been so freaked out that the girl hadn't managed to convey anything useful to her. On the plus side, the girl, whose name was Dahlia, managed to retrieve my phone after Officer Friendly knocked it out of my hands. She'd managed to drop it into one of her boot cuffs and promised to get it back to me as soon as she had the chance. I wasn't too optimistic about such a chance coming up, being bound hand and foot as I was, but I appreciated the thought. In the meantime, I gave her my name and told her that if she wouldn't mind Googling me and getting my email address to get me the phone back when the time came, I'd appreciate it an awful lot. The bus wasn't going very fast or very far. Out the window, it was all a confusion of traffic, lots of other police buses, and long delays. Several times we stopped for long periods. It felt like hours, and certainly my arms and shoulders told me it was an eternity before moving on. I dozed several times, once flopping onto the guy with the broken arm, who made a weak whimper that was worse than a scream. We got to where we were going just as the sun was coming up. It was a nondescript warehouse-type building swarming with cops. They took us off the bus two at a time, spaced out by 10 or 20 minutes. I guess that this must be processing. They left the people who couldn't walk until last. Two burly cops carried me off the bus like a sack of garbage, then went back for my seatmate. I shouted that he needed medical attention. They pretended they didn't hear. No one asked me why I was bound at the ankles, and no one moved to release me. I was hefted from one station to the next. First, I was propped up in a chair in front of a trestle table, where a couple of bleary cops with ruggedized laptops, about 1/1,000,000th as cool and military-looking as the ones that Timmy and Knothead had, fingerprinted me, retina-scanned me, swabbed my cheek for DNA, and then took my name and address and social security number. I told them I declined to answer any further questions. I told them I wanted to see a lawyer. I told them I needed to pee. I asked them what I was under arrest for. I drilled this routine a zillion times, but it was a lot harder to do in handcuffs than it was in front of the bedroom mirror when I was having what Mom called collie wobbles about the thought of being arrested someday. They weren't impressed. Their responses, in order, were, "Spell yellow again? We don't have any further questions. Later. Later. And disorderly conduct and conspiracy to disturb the peace." They called out to someone else, and then I was picked up, the whole chair came with me this time, and taken to a fingerprinting station. Then they took me indoors and led me into a cold, bright room that looked like it had once been a supervisor's office, or maybe a foreman's room, and strip-searched me. At least they cut loose my cuffs for this. I chafed at my wrists and ankles, doing my best not to whimper as the blood started to flow to them again. There were 15 or 20 other guys in there, and we avoided one another's eyes as we stripped off our clothes and stood shivering and naked while more bored cops went from one person to the next, searching our clothes with hands clad in surgical gloves, like we were infected with some kind of vermin or virus. They looked in our armpits, under our testicles, up our butts. It was one of the most humiliating experiences of my life, partly because it was so bored and clinical. These guys had nothing personal against us. They could have been government health workers inspecting beef on the way to market. It's surprising how philosophical being shivering, terrified, and naked in police custody can make you. If you'd have asked me how I'd have felt about these guys beforehand, I would have told you that I hated them, thought they were gutless cowards, and worse. They were traitors to humanity, people who made their living defending the interests of the wealthy and corrupt and powerful from everyone else. I'd seen them commit violence, seen them arrive at a peaceful protest dressed up like science fiction super soldiers, seen them bristling with supposedly non-lethal weapons and treating people who were scared and upset about the world like vermin. But there we were, two groups of human beings in a cold room, one group naked, one group wearing overblown Halloween costumes, and none of us wanted to be here. We had parts we'd been given by some weird, unimaginable authority, the system, and now we had to act them out. I could see that the cops in the room would rather have been pretty much anywhere else, doing pretty much anything else. But there they were, looking up our buttholes and getting ready to throw us into cages. There was a knife-edged moment where I felt like I could just pull on my underwear and walk up to the nearest cop and say, "Come on, dude, let's be reasonable about this." And we could have talked it over like real people who lived in the same city with the same problems. This guy might have kids who are going to get stuck paying off $250,000 worth of student debt or he'd lose his house. That guy was young enough that he might actually be living with his parents and trying to pay off that debt. The moment stretched and broke. Our clothes were patted down and shaken out. Then we were allowed to dress again. They cuffed us again, too. I silently begged the universe to keep me free from ankle cuffs and thought I'd made it when the cop who was trussing me up seemed to remember that I'd been ankle cuffed and reached for his belt again. "It's okay," I said. "You don't have to do that." He pretended he didn't hear me, but grabbed one of my ankles and started to cinch the zip strip around it. "Come on, man," I said, wheedling and whining now, hating the sound of it in my voice. "It's really not necessary." The guy made eye contact with me and grunted. "You did something to earn those cuffs. Not my job to figure out whether it's time to get rid of them." I squeezed my eyes shut. This guy had no idea why I'd been cuffed, but because I'd been cuffed, I obviously deserved to be cuffed. Tom was long gone, and so was the inspector who'd rescued me. I could imagine wearing leg cuffs all the way to the courthouse and the judge and being denied bail because I was the kind of dangerous offender who got leg bindings. I shuffled out of the foreman's office and into the main building. The cavernous space had been fitted with mesh cages, stretching in corridors as far as I could see. The cages were made of chain link and steel poles, the poles bolted to the floor and ceiling at precise intervals, slicing the room into little pens. Each one had an electric lock fitted to its hasp, an open-air chemical toilet, and a collection of grim-looking prisoners. Men were on one side of the central aisle, women on the other. One by one, the cops tossed us into different cells, following instructions on their hardened, tactical handheld computers. I decided that tactical was the world's most boring fashion statement. Sometimes they put guys into cells that were so full there was no room to sit. Other guys went into cells where they were virtually on their own. Several cells sat empty. Whatever sorting and packing algorithm was being used to incarcerate us, it had a sense of humor. I ended up in one of the nearly empty ones, and was glad that my hands had been cuffed in front of me, because I was finally able to take the piss that had been trying to batter its way to freedom for the past several hours, sitting down on the exposed toilet and hunching over for privacy, then fumbling my underwear and pants back up. Within a few hours, the cell had gone from empty to full, Yes, I said, hours. More hours went by. It felt like we'd been there for a day, though there was no daylight, and everyone had had their watches and phones confiscated. I got to know some of the guys in my cell, and someone tried a mic check and gave a little speech about how much it sucked that we were being held this way, and asked the cops to uphold the law and give us our phone calls and food and water. He got cheers from the other protesters in the cells, and the cops pretended they didn't hear. Hours oozed past. People had come and gone for so long that I stopped paying attention. I was hungry and thirsty, and the toilet was overflowing and making revolting smells and starting to ooze a sickening chemical slick that reduced the space in the cell. Finally, I realized that the whole place was quieter and emptier than it had been before. More people were going than coming. They weren't coming back. So they were going somewhere, possibly to get their phone calls and their hearings. Finally, officers came for me, two of them. They sliced the middle of the cuffs around my ankles so that I could walk, and I saw that nearly all the cells toward the front of the building were empty. A tingle of hope came into my belly, joining the hunger growls and the pasty, parched thirst. We came out to the same foreman's room where I'd been searched. A woman police officer, older, black, took my fingerprints again, read notes off a screen, typed, didn't say anything. It's a good thing she didn't, because I kept forgetting that I wasn't going to say anything to her unless I had a lawyer present. She nodded at the guys who'd brought me out, and they gripped my arms and walked me to the door. I emerged to cold gray daylight and a light drizzle. There were thousands of people standing across the street, holding signs and chanting. The officers brought me to the curb, then let go. "You're done," one said. "What?" I said. "Go," the other one said. "You're done." "What about the charges?" "What charges? You want us to press charges?" After all that, they were just going to let me go. Some part of me wanted to say, "Hell yeah, I want you to press charges. Otherwise, what the hell just happened here? A kidnapping?" The people across the street with the signs and banners were angry. Now I understood why. "What a load of bullshit," I said with feeling. The cops' faces slammed shut. I stood my ground. I was scared as hell, but I stood my ground. Let them grab me, chain me up, arrest me, put me in jail, waterboard me, try me, find me guilty, send me up for life. That was a load of bullshit, and I had every right to say it. We stared at each other like dogs about to fight. I noticed that the people across the street had gotten quieter, then louder. I was peripherally aware of a lot of people with a lot of camera phones maneuvering into position near me. I guess the cops were, too. One of them turned and walked back. Then the other one. I was shaking. My fists clenched so hard my fingernails actually broke the skin on my palms in a couple of places. The protesters patted me on the back. It seemed that they knew what I was freaking out about. There was a table laden with free food. Someone had brought down a whole crap ton of lentils and rice and PB&J sandwiches and hot pizzas. And five different people asked if I had any money to get home and whether I needed to talk to a doctor. I sat down on the curb amid the shouting, jostling people and wolfed down about 100,000 calories worth of food, eating mechanically, stopping only once I'd run out of food. Then I got up, dusted off my filthy clothes, and walked away, finding my way home, though I couldn't even tell you how I got there.